guys, good morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you're listening to this podcast, and welcome back to Teachable Psych. My name is Sarah Jane, your host, and this week's guest features Mercedes Munoz, a graduate student in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience, working in the Duke Identity and Diversity Lab and the Duke Culture Lab. Today, we talked about her interests in both social and developmental psychology, and more specifically, how children and adults develop an understanding of racial categories. Now, if this remotely interests you, please continue listening to this episode, and I'll see you at the end.
It's really nice to meet you. My name is Mercedes Munoz, and I'm a third-year PhD student in psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. And I'm excited to be chatting with you today.
Awesome. Thank you. So this first question is very broad, so you can take it however you like. It's, how do you think education is associated and or correlated with psychology?
That's a good question. I think that, at least from my perspective as a graduate student and somebody who's learning to teach psychology, those things can be extremely intertwined. I think that teaching psychology is something that can either be really creative or really fun, or it can be really monotonous or very memorization heavy. And I think that as the universities are trying to prepare educators of future college students, they're really leaning towards a very interactive classroom environment. I think that teaching psychology is something really interesting. Of course, I think that at different levels of education, we can all benefit from are having a basic understanding of psychology, such as, how social groups form, how dominance hierarchies form, especially in classroom settings, the best ways to transmit information in ways that are going to be digestible to other people, understanding people's cultural components, how those influence how people learn and develop, I think, are all very important. I don't know if that answers
your question. That was a great response. So what got you interested in psychology, or what promoted you to further your education in psychology?
When I was in high school, I was really interested in human behaviors and the human brain and the human mind. And I thought that I really wanted to be a therapist and give therapy and be a clinical psychologist. So when I got to college, I was a psychology major and I really enjoyed it, and I got involved in a developmental psychology research lab. And although it didn't have anything to do with what we call abnormal psychology, which is things related to depression or anxiety or PTSD or things like that, it was a really interesting gateway into what psychology could be outside of what we usually think of psychiatric disorders and things of that sort. So I got really interested in developmental psychology, so how children learn about the world, how we form perceptions about different groups, about different types of concepts, how kids understand causality. Those were really interesting to me, and I kind of shifted away from my desire to be a therapist or a clinician and was more so interested in answering these questions about the world. I learned that I really had a passion for understanding psychology in terms of communities that aren't traditionally represented in a lot of research, minority communities, and how where you're from and the culture that you're in and influence and think about the world. So that's kind of how the research that kind of pushed me to better want to understand the world a little more deeply. And graduate school in psychology just kind of made sense for me in terms of furthering my research desires and wanting to just learn more about the world.
That's amazing. So earlier you said how you think you would benefit almost anyone having a basic understanding of psychology. So how do you think it would benefit teachers, a specific course for them, especially to improve teacher-student relationships, especially as in public schools, one teacher usually has to teach 30 up to 30 students at a time?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, sorry, my cat is running around. I think that especially for older students, so high school and beginning college students, something that I'm really passionate about, especially when teaching non-white students, is this idea of congruence of like your home life, like your home values and your like school values. So essentially what that means is like, you know, if you're at home, like you live a very like together oriented life with your family, what we call like really interdependent, you're like part of a unit and you kind of take everyone in your family's feelings into account and like, you know, people do activities together. And when you go to school or when you go, when you first go to college, it can be really isolating to all of a sudden be like completely independent or like be expected to do things on your own or to like not have like kind of a collaborative communal environment. A lot of non-white, especially like Latinx and Black students struggle in schools that aren't like congruent with their values, especially a lot of like first, and when you get to college, a lot of first students struggle with that transition from a very interdependent home life to very independent school life. So I think that if teachers were to be more understanding of those kinds of incongruencies in terms of values and just cognitions of students that are more underrepresented in their classroom settings, it could help the teacher relationship to have a teacher who understands where you're coming from and what you like, what, how you learn best, if that's like, you know, in a group setting, if you need more specialized one-on-one instruction. Not everyone can just like get it by themselves on their own, and some of that can be attributed to like how, what our cultural context looks like. That would be something that would be interesting to observe further.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I never thought about that, how your home values can also influence the way you learn in school. So can you explain the organizations you've worked with, such as the Duke Culture Lab, and how that's impacted your education?
Sure. So here at Duke, I work in two labs. So what that means is that my doctoral education is kind of overseen by two professors. So one is Dr. Sarah Gaither, and she runs the Identity and Diversity Lab here at Duke. And the other one is Dr. Christina Salvador, and she runs the Duke Culture Lab. So I'm really grateful to be involved in two labs that really push science forward in a way that prioritizes the voices of underrepresented groups. So that's something that I've really valued in my education. I think it's really rare, especially at an institution like Duke. And I was able to become really involved by, you know, having a really good relationship with both of my professors, and for undergraduate students or students in high school that are interested in doing research in psychology, it's always a really good idea to become really, you know, really involved and really close to your professors. A lot of professors, especially at big research institutions, are always looking for undergraduate students to work in their labs. That's how I got involved in research when I was in undergrad. And it can be a really good like opening into understanding what you might want to do in the future. So our labs always have like a bunch of undergrads running around helping us do our work. And that's how all of our work gets done. It's a very collaborative environment. And other organizations that kind of have helped shape like our research trajectories, we partner with like a lot of community organizations. So a lot of my work is also developmental psychology. So I work with a lot of children. So we have a partnership here at in Durham, North Carolina, with the Museum of Life and Science, which is really awesome. So twice a week, I go down with some undergrad students and we collect data. We have a little spot in the museum where families can walk by and participate in our studies. So that's a really cool community-oriented approach to helping us get our data. We're also really passionate about like diversifying our participant pool. So a big problem in psychology is that a lot of our samples for our studies are just not representative of what the world looks like or even what the United States looks like. It's a lot of white children and a lot of white adults, but one problem at a time. So we are really passionate about increasing the diversity of our participant pools. So we do recruitment events that we, you know, go out into the malls, we go out to farmers markets, different types of community-oriented events, and engage with the community, have them know what we do, encourage them to sign up to be contacted to participate, especially if they're of a diverse background. So it's all about like building trusting relationships with communities of color, because a lot of those don't really exist because of past, you know, mistakes and horrible things that were made, you know, with populations that were vulnerable. So now we kind of have a responsibility to kind of rectify these things, and we're trying to do so in a way that is, you know, community oriented.
Oh, that sounds really nice. Do you guys have a current research project that you're working on?
Yeah. So the project that we're collecting data for at the museum is a project that looks at ways that we can reduce kind of stereotype development in children. So when we, even though you might not mean like all boys are good at sports, children kind of internalize those language markers as like, you know, sweeping generalizations. And that's how we begin to develop stereotypes about gender, stereotypes about race, about certain groups of people. So we're looking and exploring how children process and categorize and generalize different types of language quantifiers. So like most, half, and a few. So if we say, you know, a few girls like pink, if children will generalize less about that category, if we change how we talk to kids about different categories. So that's what our project is working on right now, kind of with the goal of reducing, finding language that we can use to talk to children about categories that will reduce potential generalizations or stereotypes in the future.
Is there a difference in age group? Like, are you specifically working on elementary students or middle school? Are you comparing them?
Yeah, so we do elementary school students. So this study in particular is 4 to 7 years old. And we're collecting enough data to be able to see if there are any age differences between those different categories. So it's possible that four-year-olds might answer in a different way than a seven-year-old. And we should be able to see what that looks like. We also sometimes will group our samples into like younger kids and older kids. So maybe 4 or 5 is the younger and then older is like 6 and 7. And we can analyze our data in different ways to answer the different questions we might have about age differences.
But do you take into account like their sibling status, like how their role also affects their younger siblings or the family?
Yeah, so we have demographic information of how many siblings the child has and like birth order of like, is this, how many older siblings does this child have? How many younger ones do they have? And usually we don't necessarily always look at that contextual information because we need a certain amount of kids in each category to achieve a certain number of like statistical power to be able to get any significant results. And usually there's just too much variation in the and like children's birth orders to be able to capture what we need exactly. But I do think that, you know, kids who grow up with a sibling, either a younger sibling or an older sibling, whether they are being taught things about the world from their sibling or are teaching their siblings things about the world, can definitely influence how they process information about different types of groups and different types of people in general.
So I know you talked about it earlier, how you're focused on like students with diverse backgrounds. Could you explain more about that and what it means by norm enforcing language?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, in developmental psychology and a lot of social and cognitive psychology and neuroscience in general, a lot of the samples that are used in a lot of the research that is conducted even today are not really representative of the U.S., you know, demographic. So it's a lot of like 70 to 80% white European participants. So if, you know, we're conducting research but only on specific populations, then we're not really sure it's generalizable to a variety of different people. So something that we do in both the Duke Identity and Diversity Lab and the Duke Culture Lab is pay specific attention to populations that are understudied historically in psychology. One of the projects that I'm working on with Dr. Salvador in the Duke Culture Lab looks at how different racial ethnic groups in the U.S. understand the strength of their social norms. So that is, has to do with norm enforcing language. So what we do is we have really cool research looking at how European Americans, Black Americans, Latinx Americans, and East Asian Americans understand the strength of their community's social norms. So we ask them questions like, oh, in your racial ethnic community, are people allowed to do this? Can people do this? So we're trying to understand the social norm strength of their community. So if a community is really strong in their social norms, then they have a low tolerance for deviant behavior and like very strong norms, versus if a community has very weak social norms and they are kind of loose, weak norms and a very like high tolerance for deviance, so people can basically do whatever they want. So what we thought was, you know, previous research says that the United States is kind of a loose country, like it has very weak social norms. But Dr. Salvador and I were thinking, well, maybe that just means that in those previous studies, maybe they've only sampled with European Americans, and that maybe East Asian, Latinx, and African Americans could have stronger social norms within various racial ethnic subcultures that the United States has. So that's what we see in our research. We see that East Asian Americans have the strongest community norms. So they perceive their communities to have, you know, really strong social norms, followed by Latinx Americans and then Black Americans. And in all of our research, all of those norm strengths for each community are always stronger than European Americans. So these are all things that we could never have discovered if we were never thoughtful to include diverse samples in our research in an intentional way. And that tells us a lot about how the world kind of operates in terms of the different constructs we're interested in studying.
When you look at your categories of like East Asian, Latinx, and then Black, do you guys look further into the specific regions and different like ethnicities within it, or is it just pretty broad right now?
Yeah, so right now we're kind of, since we're the first to kind of take this level of analysis approach with these kinds of constructs, it's starting pretty broad. So we picked the four largest racial ethnic groups in the United States, but in our future research, we're hoping to delve deeper into these types of regional or country level differences. You know, even Latin America in and of itself is, you know, like comprised by so many cultures and countries. And so all of these we know are not a monolith. But what we're finding is that there could be something specific about being a minority in the United States that is like igniting this stronger social norm strength. But it all depends on like the level of analysis that you want to look on. So kind of when you have like a telescope, you can either like go really broad or you can go like be really focused on a smaller unit of analysis. So it all just depends on the researchers and what we're interested in finding out. But I think that's a really important next step for our research, is just kind of digging deeper into the subcultures that we might be interested in pursuing.
You say you're gathering data in like your local community. How does that population pool is dictated by where you live? Because there's not a certain like pool of a certain population in every single city.
Yeah, so definitely something that has kind of broadened the scope of psychology research has been the COVID pandemic. So a lot of things actually went online once after the summer of 2020. So a lot of our adult samples we actually get on the internet. So using like Amazon Mechanical Turk or a platform called Prolific. So adults from all over the United States can take our studies if they want to, and they get paid for them. Developmental psychology work is a little bit different. We still collect the majority of our participants in our lab online. So yes, anyone can sign up to participate in our lab studies on our website, which is the Duke ID Lab. And so if anyone is interested, you can sign up online and we'll do like a virtual Zoom session with folks. So that kind of allows us to be a little bit more free of like the limits and constraints of our environment. But I think that for our in-person studies, it definitely does matter where you live. So for the studies that we conduct at the Museum of Science, we get a lot of, we still get a relatively diverse pool of participants, but a lot more white participants, high income participants, because you have to pay to get into the museum. So these are all kinds of things that we are trying to kind of barriers that we're trying to overcome when trying to recruit diverse samples of participants. So that's why we do our recruitment events. We go to free events, like going to the mall, going to farmers markets, going to different types of outdoor events like summer festivals, where we can talk directly to community members that maybe come from more diverse economic and racial ethnic backgrounds. Here in Durham, North Carolina, we're really lucky. We actually have a really diverse population of people. So we have a large like Black population, a large Latino population. About 30 minutes away, we have a very large South Asian and East Asian populations. So we're really lucky in that regard, and that allows us to kind of do our research in a more intentional way. But it would definitely be very different if we lived in a community that was much more homogenous. It would definitely be harder to implement some of the goals that we have for the future of our research.
How does teachers' and peers' behaviors towards students of color impact their social life at school?
Yeah, so I think that obviously if teachers and students are not respectful or understanding of their peers' identities in general, whether that's a gender identity, a sexual orientation, race, ethnicity, those can all lead to like a negative schooling experience. I think that schools have a responsibility to ensure their students' safety and comfort in the classroom. And a lot of those things can come in the form of, you know, like school bullying, teachers also like their inability to act when somebody is like bullying another student can be detrimental to a student's learning process. I think that a teacher has as someone who's like training to be a college professor, I think the teacher of a classroom has like a certain responsibility and like ownership of the classroom and what happens in the classroom. And if something inappropriate is happening in the classroom towards one of your students, that's the teacher's responsibility to act on it and, you know, mediate conversations between students to be able to make sure that the classroom environment is comfortable for everyone. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Oh, yeah, it does. So this is more about your education. So can you explain your process of furthering your education field, such as applications, interviewing, and networking?
Yeah, definitely. I would say the application process for a PhD in psychology is very rigorous is always a word that I would use. But it's definitely very, community oriented, in the sense that a lot of the time, if you have good mentors in undergrad, they can be very helpful in like helping you prepare your application. So I was very lucky that I had grad students and postdocs in my lab in undergrad that were really just invested in my success. So I was very grateful to have them to help me, you know, read over my statements, to have professors write me letters of recommendation. So you need like 3 letters of recommendation, personal statements, a CV, which is like a long resume. And so just deciding where you want to apply to grad school can be a really overwhelming experience. So those people that know more than you at the time can be very helpful in guiding you to kind of the institutions that you might want to work in, people that you might want to work with. So something unique about getting a PhD in psychology is that you're not necessarily applying to a school, you're applying to a professor. So I knew that I wanted to work with my advisor, Dr. Gaither, and so I applied to Duke, but I said, you know, I want to apply to work with her. And so at the end of the day, she decides who she wants to let in her lab. You're just kind of applying to that lab in particular. So that's kind of your home. You have to know who at the university you want to work with specifically. And it's a bit different than undergrad admissions, where like the prestige of your school is thought to matter a lot. Like if you go to Harvard, that's like, wow, that's so cool. But for grad school, it's more so like the person that you work with. So like the best person, the most famous researcher for the thing that you want to do the most, might be at a school that you maybe would never have applied to otherwise, but you really want to go there because that's where they are. And so that can be sometimes like a hard mentality to change, to think that like, oh, I shouldn't be thinking about like going to Harvard anymore. Like I need to think about how my research is going to progress at this institution and with whom. So that's really, really interesting shift compared to like, you know, college applications. But yeah, the interview process can be really exciting. I applied to graduate school in the fall of 2020. So I did all of my interviews on Zoom. So in the past, I've been told that, you know, people used to fly applicants out for interviews. I basically picked a graduate school on the vibe. So I was like, oh, I really like the people that I met at Duke. I'd never been in North Carolina ever. I was picking schools based on the conversations I had with the professors that I wanted to work with and their students and whether they seemed happy. That was something that was really important to me, was to, you know, that I was going to spend the next 5 to 6 years in a community that I felt like aligned with my own values. Like I mentioned earlier, like I'm a very community oriented person. And I wanted to work with professors who really valued community and like the science journey and like the work environment. So I got really lucky in that regard that Duke was a place that did that, and they wanted me there and I wanted to be there. So that was really exciting. But it can be a long process, the whole thing. You apply like at the end of November. Interviews usually are in January to March, and then you like March to April, you decide like what's going to happen with the rest.
Hi guys, and welcome back. I hope you enjoyed this month's episode as much as I did. And if so, please feel free to leave a comment on the Q&A section of this episode. Thank you so much again to Mercedes Munoz for the insight and knowledge she's provided with us. Now, I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you listen to this podcast, and I'll see you next time.